Hi everybody, welcome along to class. Let's begin as we normally do by doing a short breathing meditation, and I'll set up a visualization and we'll set our motivation for being here. Just make sure that you're comfortable in your seat and make sure that your back is straight and shoulders relaxed. And place your hands wherever you like, and you can keep your eyes open or close them. And while you continue to breathe normally and naturally, become aware of movements that will take place either at the abdomen or upper chest each time you inhale or exhale. So you're breathing normally and naturally, and there is movement taking place out of the abdomen or upper chest, and you are aware of that. And being aware of that movement, allow yourself to relax and be present. You might be aware that the body is breathing itself. And each breath you take is different from any other breath. And each breath has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And this is because they are produced by causes and conditions. They are impermanent. Like the mind, like our body, and like our possessions. All of them are impermanent simply because they're produced by causes and conditions. And the very same causes that produce your mind, your body and the breath, and your possessions and life also make them disintegrate moment by moment. This fact that things have a nature of impermanence indicates that they're not under their own power. They function under outside influences. By mistaking what disintegrates moment by moment for something constant, we bring pain upon ourselves as well as others. So from the depths of the heart, we should seek to get beyond the round of suffering which is induced by mistaking the impermanent to be permanent. To help us do that, we take refuge in the teacher, Buddha, and his Dharma, the teachings, and the spiritual community. We can imagine their being present right now. I think the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have come from the 10 directions of space and abide above the crown of your head. And you're going to rely upon them to put an end to the clinging to the impermanent to be permanent. You're going to rely upon them to put an end to the causes of suffering for yourself and for the sake of others. So with this being our intention, we'll go for refuge to the three jewels. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Then, stabilizing this wish and making it stronger, we recite the four immeasurable thoughts. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Now, to accomplish enlightenment for the benefit of others, we need to abandon everything that hinders us and adopt everything that promotes that wish. These practices are all summed up in the Seven Limb Prayer, so we'll recite that together. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. The greatest, the object that we have the greatest clinging to is our body, a sense of self, and the different ideas that we have about ourselves and the world. I think we've got to let go of this clinging. In the absence of it, a wonderful pure land arises whereby all beings can take teachings from us in the future. We're going to offer this up to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in front of us. Now this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this is a Buddha field of offering. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamaya Tayami. So the offering of this pure land is accepted by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas above the crown of our heads. They smile at us with delight. This vast field of merit begins to dissolve into light, melting into the central figure of the Buddha. The emanation leaves his heart, moves through space, and comes to abide above the crown of your head. This emanation descends through space, entering the crown of your head and coming to rest at the level of the heart, whereby the light begins to increase, filling your body and mind. Light goes out further, going up through the pores of your skin, filling the 10 directions of space. Wherever there are beings within space, think that they are touched by this light and transformed and become fully awakened beings. Anything that light rays emanate from the heart of each one of these measureless, numberless beings, once again filling all of space. Because there's no difference between yourself and anyone else. There's no outer, there is no inner. Because outer, inner, self and other exist as mere conceptual imputations. At this level, these have vanished. We understand them to be just names. So you rest in mere space. And we recollect that we need to help everybody. So this recollection, and all the light rays begin to withdraw, and they once again re-enter your chest at the level of the heart. You feel yourself embodied, breathing normally and naturally, and you're sitting on your seat. And as you breathe normally and naturally, once again, just reaffirm the intention to fully awaken, to bring about the welfare of yourself and every other living being. Now, breathing in deeply through your nostrils, exhale through the mouth, and just allow your eyes to flutter open and your attention to be brought back to where you are. Okay, so we've come to this class, it's number 5, this series of 8. We've covered a bit of material. So in brief, we've looked at what emptiness is and what it's not. So what it's not is nothing whatsoever. That's what it's not. We can say that it's the quality of anything that does exist. It's a negation, it's also an ultimate truth. It's related to liberation and enlightenment, because without the wisdom that realizes this emptiness, we can't bring about our own personal freedom and we can't help others do the same. To realize this wisdom and to either bring about our own liberation or help others to do the same requires that we sort of purify the mind from the different types of clinging and grasping and the different types of afflictive emotions that we have, and generate enough sort of mental power to try to understand the wisdom. Now, the wisdom is taught from many different perspectives. There are many different ways of presenting it, and there are many different systems for doing so. So the original teacher, of course, was the Buddha himself. Then there was Nagarjuna, Asanga, Buddha Palita, Vasubandhu. There were many other different teachers who taught this wisdom realizing emptiness. And so some people taught it in a very sort of a gross fashion. Some taught it in the subtle fashion. But this wisdom is always aimed at overcoming ignorance. So this here is not an ignorance that doesn't know things. It's an ignorance that misapprehends things, that misknows, that wrongly knows things. And this wisdom is to cut the root of that so that you actually see things clearly. So instead of seeing things having the inherent existence that they appear to have, you see very clearly and directly that they actually dependently arise and so forth, are empty of inherent nature. Last week we looked at this emptiness of inherent nature in regards to persons. And we primarily looked at it from the point of view of a school called the Great Exposition School. And we looked there and saw that the persons were empty of a gross form of self, but they're also empty of a subtle type of self. And the gross form of self that they were empty of was being permanent, independent, and single. So persons just aren't permanent. They don't exist independently of the causes and conditions that produce them. And they're not a single entity. But because people have past, they have a future, and have a present. So that there are parts, they're not single. And we also had a look at the more subtle nature of the person within that system. And there we saw that the person was empty of self-sufficiency and substantial existence. And this form, the way that this, how we can become aware of this type of self, the self that is sufficient unto itself or substantially existent, is when the self appears to be independent of the body and mind. So the self that appears to be independent seems to be real, established by itself, and substantial, real. And this, you know, I see the simplest way of finding how we can do that is we have a self, and we talk about things like, I've got a body, I've got a mind. I possess a body and I possess the mind. I am the owner of these. Now, this I that possesses the body and possesses the mind seems to be separate from them. Like a person can be separate from your shoes. You have a pair of shoes, they're yours, but you're here and the shoes are there. So when we sort of relate to ourselves or to others in that sort of way, of being a separate owner, possessor, we are mistaken. The self doesn't exist like that. Although our language certainly gives the appearance that it does. So how do we know that that's not the case? Well, we sort of dig in. We sort of pull everything apart. Just like if we were sitting here now, today, if we took, if you had a pair of shoes on, which you don't have, but if you did have, we could say we could pull everything away and end up with a pair of shoes, wouldn't we? But with the self, if we were to exist self-sufficiently and substantially, if we took away the body, you don't find the self there. That's the owner of that self. Right? So it doesn't have that type of existence. It's the same thing with the mind. It's not an owner separate from the body and mind, as we are separate from our shoes. So that was a presentation of a gross and subtle self within the Vaibhashika or great exposition system. Today we're going to have a look at another system called Sautrantika, or the Sutra system. Now, these are two very old presentations of the of this wisdom, of the Buddha Dhamma. And in fact, this sutra system may actually have come out of the great exposition system. There was like 18 different schools within the great exposition. And they were really concerned about, like, who is this person? Who is the self that transmigrates from life to life? Who is the person who reincarnates? Anyway, there's a lot of difference of opinions amongst all these different schools. And one of them sort of shifted out a bit more and became what they call the Sutra school. Now, if we could actually get in touch with one of those people, they'd probably heartily disagree about being categorized as one of those people. Because you've got to remember here, this idea of these categories were made up by the Galupa system hundreds of years later, 500-600 years later. And it was just a way of categorizing things, trying to get it. The idea of who the person is. Now, this system, the Sutra system and the Great Exposition system, they're talking about is the selflessness of the person. And that's all they're concerned with. And they're called tenet systems of the Hinayana, tenet systems of the small vehicle. So we're going to be talking about this sutra system. Next week and onwards, we're going to be talking about the systems from the Mahayana, where they're talking not just about persons being empty of a false way of being, but the whole world itself, everything that exists. So we'll look at the gross and subtle self in sutra, the emptiness of that, those two forms of self, and then who is the person within that system? Now, can anybody remember last week how the Great Exposition defined the person? They said, okay, you know, the person does exist. Well, who is that person? Can anybody remember a couple of ways that they might say? They had about five different ways. Because like I said, there's 18 different schools, and they've all got different ideas.
Five aggregates together,
that's right, was one.
Consciousness
was another, mental consciousness.
Continuum of the five aggregates
was another. And then one was like inexpressible, wasn't it? I was saying it wasn't
wasn't this and it wasn't that, but we exist. So this system has got a lot of similarities with the other, with the Great Exposition system. But I'll just read you a little bit here. This is from a book called Relative Truth, Ultimate Truth. And it was written by Geshe Tashi Searing from London. She says, like all the Buddhist philosophical schools, the aim of the Sutra School is to show the practitioner ways of developing the mind so that a correct understanding of reality can be reached and difficulties and suffering can be overcome. As one of the two lower schools, the final goal of the Sutra system is liberation and not enlightenment. Consequently, this system speaks of the selflessness of person and not the selflessness or emptiness of phenomena. Nevertheless, there are many very helpful ideas within this Sutra system, even for someone who is bent on full enlightenment. She's in particular understanding the Sutra system's ideas about ultimate truth. Phenomena that are able to perform a function, and conventional truth, phenomena that are not able to perform a function, but nevertheless have a parallel to real things. This will help us not to jump to immediate judgments and then act upon them precipitously. So I can see somebody go like this, and that's exactly what happened to me many years ago when this was introduced to me. I go, what are you talking about? And one of the things the guy said in the book was, now all of you people who've been reading about the middle way, everything you've got, just put it on the shelf. Because this presentation is the opposite of it. What these guys are saying is an ultimate truth. The middle way people say is a conventional truth. What they're saying is a conventional truth, the other people say is an ultimate truth. So I read just this section today in that particular book. And the first time, I don't know, I've been studying for 20 years. Today was the first time I was sort of getting, it's not so bad. I get a little bit of it. So like I don't read it every day, or rarely actually, the stuff about tenets. But something had changed. I'm thinking more than 20 years have gone by. You know, I say to Miffy, I wish they'd presented this bit like this the first time we studied this. Because I remember all of us like this, they're having headaches, this going like, oh my God. And but today was much clearer. What's terrific about the system is the way they present how the mind works, how the mind accesses its different objects. That's really good. And I was looking at that thing, and Western psychology's got nothing on this. These guys have really looked at how the mind functions, and you can read this and go, yeah, it makes good sense. So some of the books I've used were, of course, these ones here, but in particular I use The Relative Truth, Ultimate Truth, How to See Yourself as You Really Are, which I'm going to take you through a meditation on it, with the two major books relied upon this time. So the gross selflessness in the Sutra system is exactly the same as the gross selflessness in the Great Exposition system. They too are saying there is no permanent, singular, or independent entity of the body and mind called a self. No sort of soul type thing, nothing independent of it. It's exactly the same as last week. Now, there's a number of different meditations you can do. So remember here, meditation, I'm not saying just sitting like, your legs crossed and your eyes closed and your hands and everything, and now meditating.
And Slowly falling asleep.
Yeah, that's right, slowly falling asleep. Meditation really means, it's a verb, becoming familiar. It's a doing thing. So you can do it anytime. You just sit there and you become familiar with an idea. But the idea has to be correct, because what we want to do is put an end to suffering. And it's the wrong ideas that we have that produce the suffering. Now, if we're going to become familiar with anything, it should be like a correct idea. So the correct ideas here are, the person is not permanent. There is no permanent person. There's no person that exists as a singular entity. There's no person existing independent of the causes and conditions that produce them. So we've got to get used to that idea. Now, one of the things you can do, of course, is just to take the opposite point of view and go, well, no, persons are permanent. So if you said that, how would you shoot that down?
You couldn't age.
You couldn't age. No one would age. Because permanent goes against impermanent, doesn't it? It's the opposite of it. But we are all aging.
We'd all be vampires.
Yeah. We all die. So obviously we're not, the person, us, is not permanent. When it comes to singular, this means like without parts. But we have a couple of obvious parts, don't we? A body and a mind. We have this top part and this bottom part of our body, which that's, we call this, you know, me. We have a past, a present, and a future. They're three parts of the continuum of a person. So we're not a singular entity. And if you were independent of the causes and conditions that produced you, what are some of the causes and conditions that brought, that contributed to you being sitting here? You could say your mother and father, your parents, right? So you could exist without depending upon parents. Well, that's...
Or breakfast. If we didn't have any food, we wouldn't be sitting here.
Yeah, that's right. So this, you know, and remember here, so these schools, the lower schools, I'm all saying, you know, this is the gross self. The final school we'll come to over the next couple of weeks, the middle way consequence, go, rubbish, this is not really a thing, this is intellectual. Nobody actually thinks this deeply. But actually we behave as if we're permanent, we behave as if we're not going to die, we behave as if we're independent of the causes and conditions that contribute to our life. You think we don't, just look what we're doing to the planet. So even though this is all true, but not the deepest, you know, it's an intellectual thing, we actually behave in many ways as if we were permanent, we weren't going to die. We were just a singular entity. And that we are independent of the causes and conditions that contribute to us living, being here. There's a sort of a disconnect there. Now, also in terms of the subtle selflessness of the person, the Sutra school, once again, the person that they say does not exist is a self-sufficient and substantially existent person. That person is also absent. And remember here we had this last week. Self-sufficient means not dependent upon the body and mind. So a person can exist without having a body and mind. Well, you know, that doesn't add up either. Not to rely on anything at all, anything else. So it could be observed without the appearance of the body and mind. So, remember one time in the history of Western science, wasn't there? I think it was with Descartes, who said, you know, I think, therefore I am. And it became this division between the church and science. Because science would look, There is no soul in there, independent of your body and mind. No way. We're not going to hold on to it. We're not having that. And they said, well, we'll so I said, church, you take care of all that business. But from the scientific point of view, there is no independent person, self, soul, existing apart from the body and mind within persons. So science is really dealing with the physical world, isn't it? The physical phenomena. So you know that if you could even have a doctor today or a biologist, you go right through and pull all the parts of the body apart and go, is any one of them me or I? Is any one of these parts the thing we call a person? Is that the person? There's no biologist or doctor or anything like that would say this, the person is physical and this is it.
Some might say the brain.
Yeah, well, that doesn't make sense either, does it?
Not when you
the
start
brain
looking.
Is the person's. I mean, who falls in love with brains? No one. They fall in love with persons. Because persons get married, not brains. But yeah, they put forward this idea, haven't they? I mean, it's been put forward. But it doesn't make, you know, it doesn't take any sort of genius to look out and go, that doesn't make any sense. So we've got nothing physical. And we should also know that science really doesn't deal with the with consciousness. So does anyone here think that brains produce consciousness? Could do, you might do. And that's where you get, you know, if you did think that, then of course, when the person dies, then the brain will disintegrate, won't they? And then the person is dead, and there's no future lives or anything like that, because the consciousness depends upon the brain, and the brain's over. So there's no karma, no past and future lives, all that sort of stuff, that's out the window.
So that is a materialist view.
That's the materialist view, yeah. That's right. Yeah, so from the materialist view, if you took that, then you go, there is no self-sufficient entity called self, because you're just dealing with material stuff, you're dealing with the body and the physical stuff, and none of that's me, none of that's a person. Another simple thing you can do, if you were to exist in this particular way, it would mean that something could happen to the body or to the mind and it wouldn't affect you. Or something could happen to you and it wouldn't affect your body and it wouldn't affect your mind. But if you existed in this way. But now, once again, you just try and run it through. Is that possible? And in this system, this is a subtle selflessness of the person, just as like it was in the other system last week. Right? Great exposition system said, the gross selflessness of the person is them lacking permanence, lacking independence, and lacking singularity. There's no person like that. Right. Now, they're also, this school is also saying there isn't any person that could exist in a self-sufficient and substantial way. The person's empty of that. Now, this person. That the person is empty of, yeah, it describes a subtle selflessness. So here, like I've put this, you know, like a balloon type looking body, and then another person, like it wears it. Yeah? So that's how we're not. We're not like that.
It's very counterintuitive, isn't it? Because that's how we feel.
That's how we feel, and that's how we act a lot of the time. So we act as if we are, so what we're going to be careful about here is knocking the self out altogether. So we're not doing that. All we're doing is looking at how the self appears to exist, analyzing that appearance and seeing if that appearance is true, and finding the appearance is not true. So it's like the idea of like looking in the mirror, you know, and there's a reflection in the mirror, looks like you're in the mirror. That's the appearance, isn't it? There's a face in the mirror. So how do we know there isn't one there? Well, we investigate, don't we? And then we find, like, it's not there. It looks like it's there, but it's not there. It's the same sort of thing when you have a mirage. You might be going down the highway, and the way in the distance, there's like a whole lot of water on the road. Now, that water appears to be water on the road, doesn't it? That's what's appearing to our senses. Now, if you don't know about mirages and things, you might actually think there's actually water on the road. That's a real possibility. So how do you know there isn't any there? Well, you know, you're like, let's go and have a look. And then you see, oh, there's no water there. Do you like work out, gosh, it's, you know, and you find out or you read or somebody tells you, no, look, it's about the sun. The sun's coming down, hits this, and then this thing appears, arises. Looks like water, but there isn't any water. So with us, like we have a self. We, you know, I exist, you exist, and so forth. But then the question is like, how does it exist? Well, its appearance is just like that mirage, just like the face in the mirror. Like there appears, isn't there, that there's a self in here somewhere, the self controlling my thinking, controlling my physical actions, that needs to be protected, for instance. You know, when somebody threatens us, it's not that we're going, leave my body alone, don't speak to my mind like that. You know, we leave me alone. You're talking about me. You know? And they are talking about us. Aren't they? But then watch how your own mind apprehends your sense of self. Right? It seems to stand out independent of the body and mind. It stands sufficient unto itself. Like it's now I am being threatened. So our mind is gripping, grasping, holding on to ourself and giving it a type of existence it doesn't actually have. You know, just like there's no face in the mirror, there's no actual water on the road. But this consciousness, what they call ignorance, is grasping the eye that does exist and giving it an appearance as if it were water on the road or a face in the mirror. There's a real, like there's a real me now. More real than how we actually are. And these, you know, this talk that we're going through is just showing us how when we grasp the existent I, yeah, that does exist, when we grasp it, its appearance becomes like the self-sufficient, substantial existent. But in fact, it doesn't exist like that. But what happens is we start behaving as if it does exist like that. And the behaviors that follow are often fear or, like I say, lust, attachment. Like I want this or I don't want the other thing. These two sort of extremes. Those are things that appear very threatening to us or else very attractive to us. And this I wants to flee one and move towards the other. Now, so you talk about meditating on the selflessness of the person, and you can often start here. Now, with these schools, remember, so these are the systems, the low attendance systems, and they've got these terms, self-sufficient, substantially existing person. Later on, you'll see the person existing from their own side, the person existing by way of their own characteristics. There's all these different ways of talking about how the person appears to exist and how it could be thought they actually exist that way. Now, I think luckily for us, the final school, called the Middle Way Consequence School, says all those ideas are completely all wrong. And actually, we could just put them into, give them one name, intrinsic existence, inherent existence. You're all talking about inherent existence, all of you. But, you know, from their point of view, you just don't realize it yet. But if you think about it, there's only these two extremes. One is, and this is one of them, you are independent of the body and mind in some way, independent of the aggregates, the parts. But yet you've got to sort of say, like, who is the person, don't you? So if you're not independent, you must be. Or, yeah, depending on what, that's right, so then you're right, right. But what happens is each school has a different understanding of what dependent means. Yeah. So one thing they all agree, for instance, I'll say, if you say, who's the person? What's a person? Define a person for me. All of them say, and they all agree, it's the I that is merely imputed to the, any of the aggregates. So a person is an I. It's imputed to any of the aggregates. So the aggregates are the body and mind in brief. So yeah, the question you can ask is like, what do you mean by imputed?
And that seems to be the catch.
Yeah, that's right. So these people have, you know, some different ideas about that. The Middle Way Consequence School says, like, everything is imputed, it's not just persons. Persons are imputed to the five aggregates. But like space, for instance, is imputed on the lack of contact. Camera is imputed on this little device here that's fulfilling this function. Everything is imputed. And if you ask, like, how is it imputed? You go, with consciousness and with words, with language and consciousness. Consciousness throws up things, throws up the images. That's this process of imputation. And then we just put another layer on top called a word. And what happens oftentimes, you know, we're introduced to phenomena by saying, this is called a person. This is called a camera. This is called the desk. But very quickly we say, that is a person. That is a camera. That is a desk. So the imputation process gets lost in terms of the language, that they seem to be one and the same thing. And oftentimes with the consciousness, it's like what's appearing through consciousness, you think that's real.
So that's like that, all the conflict that happens with naming countries like Croatia and Montenegro, and then the all the, I'm just thinking of Eurovision here, and one at the, you know, beginning of the 90s, it was one country, and then suddenly it was 15 countries because they just kept on renaming each area.
And they have a lot of problems, don't they?
Yeah,
disagreements, huge, disagreements with the names, disagreements with like how they mapped it.
Well, it's even a thing of when you say something is balkanized, it just means, you know, it's like disintegrated into countless parts and unmanageable. Yeah.
So I was going to say, so when we, the most important thing with this meditation is to is to become familiar with what they call the object to be negated. So the thing is, the object to be negated is a non-existent. It doesn't actually exist, but it appears to. And what it's,
just backtrack 5 seconds. Is it correct to say that part of the misperception is of reality seems to be involving language,
yeah,
and the concepts behind language, not only perception, well, that part of perception, but specifically communication of language and the concepts behind the words. And that's instrumental in the misperception.
Yeah, it contributes to it. Yeah. Yeah, because we need language, don't we, to sort of, you know, to discriminate and say this rather than that. And we put the names on, and then what very quickly happens is that suddenly the thing comes back at us, right, as if it were already named. It's like it's real. The name, what we call the basis of designation, and the name that was put onto it, imputed to it, now appear one and the same thing.
And then with countries, some people like that because now it's that's my right. Country, and the others go, no, it's not.
And yeah, I use it to generate nationalism, don't we?
And how important is that in the scale of misperception?
So here, okay, so we go back to this first philosophy, how all the schools will agree that the person is merely imputed, or as they say, merely is imputed to any of the five aggregates, any of the parts of a person, then a person is given that name. Now, the middle way constant schools say all the other schools aren't satisfied with that. And in general, people aren't satisfied with it either. In general, very, very few people are satisfied with that. It's like, now there's got to be something beyond that, something more, something that's real. And from this perspective here, these two lower schools are saying, yeah, there is something real. It's already there, and then we put the names on. We don't have any problem with that. No, there's a body and a mind here, and we're just calling it the person.
So they're saying
right?
That the aggregates are real.
That's right. That's right. They say the aggregates are real, but there's no real person. There's no real person to be found within the aggregates. But the aggregates, the body and mind of the person, are real, for sure. Otherwise, we wouldn't have any people at all. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's a, they're like that.
It's like when we go to name our children when they're born. My husband wanted to call our daughter Samantha, and I, we can't possibly call her Samantha.
Yeah.
Why not? Because Samantha, I knew was Samantha, and she was terrible. And so I've imputed quality to that name.
That's right. That's right. I want those qualities for my daughter.
Yeah, thinking, yes.
I will give a different name.
Yeah. I can't look at her
and call her. So you get a bit like words themselves, don't they? If you say the words, oftentimes the words themselves seem to have the properties intrinsic to them.
Yeah, so who could ever be named Brad now? Oh, Madonna, that's right. I mean, you just can't, those names are finished.
Donald.
Oh, Donald!
Yes, so even the names themselves seem to have intrinsic qualities. But in fact, if you look with, you know, if you look within each letter of the name, as the name is made up of parts or sounds, you won't find these qualities we're talking about. They're not there. So how did they appear to be there? Well, we imputed them. And then they seem to come back at us from the side of the word. as if they exist over there. But I say that they don't. So these schools are saying, say here, all their sort of saying is, look, there is no, the person, you know, doesn't have this type of, there's no self-sufficient, substantially distant person, no person in permanent, so forth. But there are other things that exist like that, you know, but not persons. Ben?
I was just going to simply reiterate that. So it's like they're saying we can impute persons, but
yeah.
Aggregates, they're just
there. They're already there. That's right. Yeah, the aggregates are substantially existent, but the persons are not. Yeah, so one of the reasons they use for this is like using, like I said, within the Sautrantika or the Sutra school, they have this big thing on perception and what's real. So, well, what you perceive is real. If the consciousness is valid, that's real. Well, you never find a person that you could validly get at. What you get at is the aggregates. So that's real. There's no person within that is. So like all the Buddhist schools will agree. You go, yeah, no problem with that. But each school will say you haven't taken it far enough yet. Even though you're saying these things that we can agree, we can find these points of agreement, we also find things we disagree with. And so we want to bring this to your notice, and then you have a new school sort of taking up. Now, the most important thing, you've heard this, if you wanted to become familiar with this understanding that there is no real owner within the body and mind, there's no real controller. But like, if you think about that, it's like, Jesus, what is, So they had and we know this because we have done the analysis. The other thing is, okay, so how do I become familiar with this lack of such a person? How do I do that? Well, the first thing is, first, make sure you can identify what you actually lack. And the way to do that is to set yourself up in situations where that false I appears very strongly. So you can know. So like for one of the ones, like for instance, if you are ever, let's do meditation on it. So this is from How to See Yourself as You Really Are. They're really good meditations. Not very long, so let's just do one. So remember, we don't need to all go like this. We just have to think and try to become familiar with this. So here we go. First of all, imagine that someone else criticizes you for something you actually have not done. And they're pointing their finger at you. And they're telling you, you did this and you ruined it. So how does your eye appear to your mind when they do that? That's what you're sort of looking for. How do I appear to myself, to my mind? In what way are you apprehending yourself? The sense of I. Notice how the I seems to stand up by itself, self-instituting, established by way of its own character. So this means when it does it, like it's not your body that's rising up, is it? It's not your mind that's rising up, it's me. That's what you've got to do. Find this object first. So you put yourself in situations like it's going to come. Wow, there it is, the falsely appearing self. I actually don't exist like that, but I'm appearing to. So this is the most important part of the whole meditation, is to get that, to become familiar with how you can falsely appear to yourself and believe the false appearance and act on it. Because, I'm sure any of you, this happened for me, for instance, I would run out of patience pretty quickly. I'd be patient for a little bit, but you keep it up. I'm going to tell you something. It's probably the same thing for most of you. You know, like I would say, I'm sick of it, mate. I told you. I didn't do it. You know, they might even say, what's wrong with you? And you know, I'm not talking about your body and your mind. I'm talking about you, mate. You who are criticizing me. Let's do another one. They're that short. They're so good like this. Okay, so this. Yeah. So remember a time when you are when you were fed up with how your mind was working. How did you feel? How did the I appear to your mind at that time? In what way were you apprehending it? Notice how that I seems to stand by itself, self-instituting, established by way of its own character. So have you ever had the opportunity, have you ever lost something and you get really upset with yourself for losing that thing? So there's another one. You go, okay, just there you go. There's the self standing up on its own, self-instituting by way of its own character. It's not your body, it's not your mind, it's me. So this is the this is an I that doesn't actually exist. So what it's taking, you know, so we'll jump way ahead, right? Go up to, we ask, how do we exist? We say, well, I am merely imputed to the body and mind. So what's that actually mean? So there are different presentations of this, right? The middle way consequence, I think, is the one who's got it correct. It means that I is really, actually, just a name. And it's given to the body and mind. That's the person. That's it.
Could you refer to it as just a description?
Describe the body and mind. Would you say I or person?
If it was body and mind together, I'd say person.
Yeah, so that's a name. It's called a person. It's not the description. It's the name. A simple one, right? Like if you get a, like the thing that we call a bike. So basically we don't have any of the parts of the bike there. And then we get one wheel. We go, do you have a bike yet? No. What if we got two wheels? No. What if we got a chain? No. What if we got a seat? No. So no bike, no bike, no bike. But then somewhere along the line, what if we got the frame for it? You go, well, no. I mean, you could put all those parts in there. No, I don't have a bike. You know, why not? So, well, you've got to put them all together. Right? Okay, I'll put them all together. Does it function as a bike? Does it actually work as, you know, as this thing we're going to call a bike? Have we ever got a bike yet? When do we have bike? When we name it. There's no bike there until we've called it a bike. It's just all these parts, aren't they? And each one of them is not a bike. It's just like us. You have all the parts of the mind, not one of those parts is me. All the parts of the body, not one of them is me. But once they're together and they're functioning together, here I am. If you pull the consciousness out of the body, am I there? No, this dead body. We call it a dead body. We call it a corpse. So it needs something else. It needs the consciousness. And it's actually not a function as a person. Let me call it person. That's it. That's how it actually is. But there's so few we don't completely, we don't do that. We don't, that's how it is. But every other school don't do it that way, and we don't either. There's something else we're thinking is me. But the I that's really me is just the name. Now, what I'm saying is ignorance takes that name and makes it more than just a name. So it's not mere. It's more than that. It's self-sufficient, substantially existent. It's intrinsically existent. It is the body. It is the mind. It's something independent of them. But it's none of those. But, you know, so I can tell you this, that over time, believe me, if you think about it, you're going to go, gee, that's, it can't be any other way. But it won't stop you misapprehending yourself all the time. It don't stop it. Not knowledge of it is not enough.
Yeah, because it's not the name that suffers.
No, it's not just the name that suffers. It's the name is referring to something. You know, my body and mind. The thing it's possessing, it owns. So it's called, you know, we say, things exist in mere name. The mere person. I merely exist. So why put the mere in there? So Sue's saying there's no objective existence, which means what, Sue?
That it can't be found in there.
That's right, it can't be found in there. It can't be found within the parts, and it's not the collection of the parts. But that doesn't mean to say it doesn't exist. Of course
why,
it does.
Why can't it be the collection of the parts?
Because that's a good question. So that's the first thing that often happens is when you go through this, that's the first thing you go to. Like, I agree. It's not any part, it's all of them.
Yeah.
So think about that. Why can it not be all of them if it's not each single individual one?
Because it's not it. It's not
single ones. That's right. If you've got 50 things that are not it, and you put them together, now you've got it.
It's yeah, not, like, how? In terms of the bike, so you've got all the bits of the bike together.
Yeah.
But you got a bike. You don't have to call it a bike.
Ah, that's right. It. Now, is that true?
You've got
something. Yeah, that's right. But you don't have a bike. Not until it's called one, eh? You have the basis of designation. You have the basis. You've got something to be called a bike. But until it is called a bike, it's not a bike.
What is it?
It's just a collection of all those parts.
It's the basis of designation.
Yeah, it's called the basis of designation.
I think what confuses the issue for most people is, like, if you look at an animal, you can sort of more easily say, okay, body, simple mind, when they die, it's all gone.
Yeah.
But I think with us, what the difference is we're always wanting to know where that consciousness element comes from. That's
okay.
That hidden little thing that we've got within ourselves.
Yeah.
No one else can see. That's there with us all the time. That's right.
Conscious element. And I think that's where the confusion is when you sort of say there's nothing else in there. Well, that little thing, is that just something that's produced between the workings of the body and the mind? And, or, yeah. Yeah, so with this type of investigation, as we're talking, you know, this is important because it's the person that suffers during life, and it's the person that takes rebirth and has other lives and so forth. It's the person who will become enlightened. So there's some questions we can ask about the person. Like, who is this person that is going to get reborn? Who is the person that, you know, is us, for instance? I am a person. I am unenlightened. And I say, well, when I'm trying to become enlightened. So, but suppose, you know, as I will, come to the end of this life and die, and I'm not enlightened at that time. So who's the person that's going to get enlightened? So we've got these things, right? Now, like I said before, a person exists dependently upon a body and a mind. There's no person, like I said, this is saying over here, there's no person independent of the body and mind. So in the next couple of weeks, we're going to be talking about the other phenomena that are not the person. Because this is where this investigation goes. It goes, it's not just persons that are merely imputed. Everything is. So that means consciousness is. Right? So we have this, thing called mind or called consciousness. We've also got this thing called a person or the I. So the I is imputed to consciousness. And it's imputed to the aggregates, isn't it, really? The aggregates, the body and mind of a person. But like I said, the person is not the mind and the person is not the body. So this is what we're coming to like next week, because we can see here already, we don't exist independent of the body and mind. So then the natural thing is to go, then we are the body and we are the body or the mind. You go, well, we're not definitely not the body. Because if we were and come to die, there's no person to take rebirth. But while we're alive, I is imputed to the body and mind, isn't it? Like I said, the consciousness goes, it's just a corpse there. You're not there, you're dead, they say. So we have to ask some questions about the mind. What's its nature? How does it exist? And as I was saying before, anybody here believe that the mind is produced from the brain? Does the brain produce mental consciousness? So you can analyze that and come and go, it's impossible for that to be the case. That just can't happen. And the reason, real reason for that is because they're completely different entities. One is physical. It's got all the characters of material form, all that stuff, right? But like you said, we know consciousness has got nothing like that.
And yet our whole culture, our whole Western culture says that it does.
Yeah, no, that's right. And yet there's no evidence.
There's no evidence. It says it, right? Like it's a given thing.
It's a given thing. But like I say once again, if you analyse and break it down, you go, no, that's impossible. So then it goes, okay, so you might think, well, God, it's not coming out of it. They've got to be independent of one another. But if that's the case, that's not going to work either. That was it. If they don't depend upon one another, how do they relate? There can't be a relationship. So this presentation of future lives and so forth is really comes to fruition in Tantra, the highest Ayashaga Tantra. Because there, we're not talking about mind. We're not talking about the mind that thinks and conceives, which is the one most people think is what we're talking about, consciousness. That's not the case. That consciousness finishes at the time of death. That comes to an end too. So there we're going to talk about much more subtle levels of consciousness. Just like we can talk about subtle levels of the body.
So, Eddie, with the going on from that question, say about animals, and we can see how they have, a simple mind and they have a body, but they also have a sense of self.
Yeah, for sure.
And purpose.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so that's what I say. So animals do have a sense of self and they will protect themselves. They have a sense of purpose and so forth. There's self there. And it's just what they say, like an animal knows nothing about a permanent self, an independent self and so forth. So forget about it. But they do have this idea, self-sufficiently. It's not like the body, it's like me. There's a me animal, just like there's a me animal human being. So when we come to this other presentation, it's like, we find, you've got to sort of ask these questions. Does the mind have a beginning or not? Like, where does it come from? Like you said, it says, well, at the subtle level, it cannot come from something physical. They're two different entities. It's the same thing with physical things. Like we know, right? that you can talk about physical phenomena in a very subtle way, the most subtle being mathematics. You're talking about physical things, but you're writing them down in numbers. That's the most subtle way we deal with physical phenomena. You can go up from that and start talking about them in terms of, Miffy, what's that form of physics I use?
Quantum physics.
So you can talk at the quantum level. And you go up and then finally we're talking about form right as we see it. But like I said, there's subtleties of it. So even in the Western world of science and in the Buddhist way of things, they talk about levels of subtlety of form. And if you go right back, so form also has no beginning. There's no beginning to the physical phenomena of the world.
There's no creation of it.
It's not like there's nothing and suddenly, oh, there it is. And that's what you're sort of saying. If there's a beginning to these things, it's like, well, you know, like we often said, it's like, well, what came before that? Yes, we have these creation myths. Something did this thing. And then the whole world started to exist. So but Buddhism will argue the case that even physical phenomena have no findable beginning. Yeah, that's right. Same with the Big Bang thing, and I go, well, guess what? They say, and before that bang, there's another one. And, you know, actually Buddhism has this presentation where it's very much like Big Bangs. Whole universe goes out and then it withdraws. Right? And then it's like this crunch and then boof, back out it goes again. So there's a presentation like that in the Buddhist cosmology. But there's no first moment. It's just beginningless. Mind is the same. It can't come out of nothing, and it can't come out of something completely different than it. So once again, it's beginningless. So guess what? The self, which is imputed to that, is also no beginning. So self doesn't have a beginning because it's imputed to things that are beginningless. So the self doesn't exist independent of them, and it's not those continuums. It's not the physical continuum. It's not the mental continuum. It's imputed to them. Just like when I say, I use those words, the physical things, blah, blah, blah. That's also an imputation. So this, actually, sort of do your head in a little bit when you start thinking about it. So there's no beginning and there's no actual end. Because we can be from where we are now, it's, we can say, well, I am an unenlightened person. It'll end up with people saying, well, now I am an enlightened person. Just like the Buddha said, once upon a time, so many years ago and so many lifetimes ago, I was this person called such and such. And at the time of his enlightenment, he said, I saw all these different lives that I had. So remember, the life is imputed. I'm called this, I'm called that, I'm called this. Yep.
How far back do we go when we start to get to the point where humans didn't exist? So where does it start?
There is no findable start. There's no place we can go start here. But from there, then they do this thing of going up through these different types of realms, and they're really realms of consciousness. Now, and that's possible for us as human beings, too, is to sort of take that type of life again.
So you mean, as the human brain has evolved over time, prehistory, as we have evolved, our brains have evolved to become more enlightened in different ways?
It's not so much the brain that's enlightened, it's consciousness.
So
It's the consciousness that becomes enlightened. Yeah. But brains have certainly changed over time. There's no doubt about that.
In the Buddhist view, what is a conception?
Conceptions are, what do you call it? Simply put, they're just thoughts. So thought and conception are synonyms. And when you look at a thought, what's the term they use when you get the... Sorry? The... Yeah, so they're meaning generalities and...
Generic image,
thank you. So it's what a conception is. Right? It's a generic image. It's not the actual thing. It's what you think is that thing.
And what about the conception of an individual? Isn't that kind of beginning? I mean, there's something very... It's the beginning of the form of that individual.
The Baas has suggested baby is the name that you're giving to the form there. The term baby is a conception, an idea, plus the language you're using.
You were saying there was no beginning.
That's right.
So then what is conception? That it is the beginning of that individual's
development. Biological conception.
Sorry?
You mean biological conception?
Yeah.
Oh. Are you talking about conception or conception?
To conceive a child.
Oh, okay, right. So you could say that, so the child is actually, I think this is right, so.
So when the child is conceived, all of the chemical soup and everything, that didn't just come from nowhere, that's got a continuum.
Yeah.
And our continuum goes all the way, but not just this body, but, you know, all the way back to
the
beginning of the universe and all of those elemental forces.
So that's the physical, that's the physical continuum.
Yeah.
Okay, so anyway, but in brief, this school is saying just exactly the same as the other one we did last week, right? The gross and the subtle. Persons don't exist in this way. So they're the next thing, because they go, so how does this school posit the person? What do they say the person is? So they say this, sure. The person is this mere collection of all the five aggregates. So what's that mean? Because the meaning of mere here is a little bit different. So this is the mere collection of aggregates might sound as if our I is our entire mind and body aggregates collectively. But the word mere is important here. It means lacking in any substantial existence at all. So there's no substantially existent I within the various aggregates that are our body and mind. Because on the other hand, we almost certainly feel that our I is substantially existent in some way. Now, remember last week we said, as we pointed out at the beginning of the class, the first concepts of I were the inexpressible reality. That was one that put up. Then it was seen, you know, neither one of the aggregates nor separate from them. And so this school, the Sutra school, may have been one of the 18 that sort of broke away. So they share many ideas of what they think the self is. Then they call it the continuum. The next concept, the continuum of the aggregates, indicates that the person is not the aggregates, but that a sense of self arises due to the stream of consciousness, which in turn is a result of the chain of cause and effect of one moment of consciousness causing the next moment of consciousness. This sense of continuity gives the illusion of a substantially existent person. And finally, the mental consciousness. Another view of the person is that it is the mental consciousness. So from the four mental aggregates, it's not feeling, discrimination, or compositional factors, but purely consciousness. Now, like I said, these Hinayana schools, and even the Mahayana, except for the middle way consequence, everyone's looking for, like, who's the person? Now, how do you illustrate the person? So each of them thinks you've actually got to point at something and go, that's the person. The person's got to be real, substantially real in some way.
So these all seem very reasonable to me.
Yeah, well, actually, when you read some of the Kennan systems, you'll go, yes, 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 I agree. Yep, that's right. That's right.
Can we at least just have them real for this week?
Well, you know, so like I said, one of the the movies asking, can we have them for real this week? Well, we're already treating ourselves as if we are real, so probably, yeah. And we're really not the body or the mind, we're really the owner of them, we're really the possessor of them. That's how we're behaving. And like I said, so these schools, what they're doing is they're just saying the person does not exist like that, but the aggregates do. Everything else in the world is like for real. So next week we'll see how a new school comes along called the mind-only school. And they ask these people, if these phenomena outside, you know, not the person, but things that make up people in the world, how do these things exist then? So an atomic theory is put forward. But once again, it's like you've got to point at something as a beginning, you know, as something independent that can come together and aggregate, and then finally we get up with this thing called a person. That's really problematic. That's really difficult to do. So these guys listen to the other presentation and go, they find fault with it, and fair enough, there is a fault with it. And they put in and says, so we don't agree that such a physical world could exist independent of us. We disagree with that. So what exists then? He says, well, the only thing we can be sure of that exists is consciousness itself. Because we're always conscious of something. But the things that we're conscious of, like I said, you know, the aggregates, the body, everything like that, it does not exist in any findable, pointable, substantial way at all. There's nothing like that there. And if you think it through, they're right. There is not a world independent of our senses out there that we just get at. There's not, world doesn't exist like that. So there you go. Thing is going up. Anyway, I'll bring up a couple of things about that next week and show you also how you can sort of look at that and find agreement with it. Like I said, one of the great problems we find later on, when if we were to just end up here and go, okay, there's no real me in there, because there isn't. There's no real me in there. And actually see that, actually know it, then know it. Because you can actually do these things and go, whoa, it's impossible. Will that stop you clinging to the world? Let's stop clinging to self. Why not? That's right. The world will still seem real. Your body will still seem real. You'll go, okay, I'll grab onto this. This is me. And that's what you do.
Right? Instinct to survive.
That's right. That helps us survive, eh? That's right. So even though it's a wrong consciousness, it keeps us surviving. And it keeps us surviving within cyclic existence. Right? It keeps us suffering, going round and round. It keeps us alive, no doubt about it. But every time we live, we die. And then we get all the problems that go along with life and death. So that's the problem that comes with just refusing this type of self. So this is the person, we're just about over. What does this mean to me? Once again. So I put this one up here because like I left this big hollow in there because there's no real self there. Every object of my use and enjoyment does not belong to a real me in there that can possess it and hold it. And this, my body, speech, and mind are not under my control. There's no real controller there. This is like, you know, the first noble truth to understand. You're not in control. That's what the truth of suffering tells you. You're not in control. If you were, why would you bother suffering? Why would we put ourselves through all this hardship? So if you have like problems with different types of addictions, this is very good to know. Because the person you're trying to satisfy, he ain't there.
Right, so that's why it doesn't actually work. That's why I can't get satisfied.
That's right. Yeah, that person will never, ever, ever be satisfied. We're trying to get water from a mirage. Trying to stop our thirst through drinking mirages. It ain't going to happen. So there's a lot that's really practical that you can take away from this. Like I said, especially if you do this, first of all, identifying the object of negation, and then finding out that you know, if that I was really there, really did exist in the way it's appearing to you, how could your body affect it? How could your mind affect it? It shouldn't. But it does, right? It's false. It's false. That should do, shouldn't it?
1 minute.
1 minute. Like I said, so there's a lot. Like I said, so you can change the way you view the objects that you use. The welfare of the body, which once seemed to rely primarily upon you as a self-sufficient user of the body, is reversed. It's the same thing with the mind. There's no you there like that.
That's exactly what I was kind of thinking about before. Like the idea, ages ago, I remember saying to you, so it's like, you know, this existence of us is, we're greater than the sum of our parts and, you know, and that's what it feels like. That's what it seems like. But to, like, the person is not greater than the sum of its parts. It's just the sum of its parts. Is disappointing. because it's like the experience of being a human, a person, is so cool. It's really cool. But to, you know, but it's like, okay. I'm not that special. Great.
It's not that cool. That's right.
Yeah, and so, but I think, like, as I've, like, kind of been getting my head around it and coming to understand that, it's like I realise now that I kind of have valued my mind over my physical body, you know, for many years because it can do really interesting things, like think and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But taking that sort of sense of self out of it, it's like, oh, actually, this physical form that I live in, it and how amazing its functions are and all of that sort of stuff, is more valuable than I had given it credit for because, it's part of that thing that affects my experience, you know, my existence, what I feed it, you know.
It's the basis of us.
Yeah, what, you know, what I, how I exercise it or not. it is such an important part to my state of being that I don't think I gave as much value to before.
So here, one of the things you could take away from this is you've really got to look after your body and mind. Now, like I said, there's no real I in there that needs looking after, but your body and mind need looking after. So we should look after them. The next lot we'd go, and the body and mind aren't you either, so don't look after them too much. This is how we go. We're just extreme. So. Yeah, we'll talk about that next week. So we've sort of come to the end of our thing. We've looked at this, like I said, the gross and subtle self, very similar to what we looked at last week with the great exposition system. The emptiness of it, once again, it's the same, empty of permanence, independence, singularity, self-sufficiency, and substantial existence. And who the person is within that system, is they present three different presentations. Next week, so have a look, if you get up online, have a look at these readings you can have a look at. And we'll have a look at selflessness and emptiness in the Mahayana systems next week. So primarily we'll have a look at the mind-only presentation and a bit from the middle way autonomy presentation.
So you haven't actually been talking about emptiness yet, have you?
No. You've
just been selflessness.
We're talking about selflessness. But really from the Mahayana point of view, selflessness and emptiness is the same thing. You know, like they're saying, in terms of emptiness here, the person is empty of blah, 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 and that's the selflessness of the person. So I hope to see you all next week, and we can think about it again and talk about it.
Which eye are we going to see next week? That's the question.
So this is not just philosophy. It's like we should be trying to like apply this to ourselves. You know, because we do, we are acting in mistaken ways. We're trying, like I said, we're trying to please a self that does not actually exist. And that self, because it doesn't exist, cannot be pleased. That's why you keep changing your mind all the time. You want more, you want this, you want that, and on and on and on. Well, so if you just get your head around that, you can start just pulling back a little, you know, becoming more and more content with what you do have. And like I said, looking after your body and looking after your mind, because these things actually exist, just like I does, but not like that. So dedicate the virtues that have no intrinsic existence, but do dependently exist in mere name. Towards the goal of enlightenment that we're seeking, which also doesn't intrinsically exist, but does exist in mere name. May we become enlightened as quickly as possible to do that. Okay, thank you, everyone.